And the president looked and acted, one journalist noted, like a man who had just invented peace of mind, peace of soul, or both. Johnson's euphoria did not last. The initial flurry of peace talks petered out. The war that had ravaged both Vietnam and America continued its ruinous course. The fault line through Lyndon Johnson's presidency would split his legacy and haunt him for the rest of his life.
Epilogue of Death and Remembrance. Just as there was no single path that four young men of different background, ability, and temperament followed to the leadership of the country, so toward the end of their lives, they harbored different thoughts about the afterlife of leadership, of death, and remembrance. While their personal stories came to very different ends, they were all looking beyond their own lives, hopeful that their achievements had shaped and enlarged the future. The fame they craved, the recognition they sought, bears little resemblance to today's cult of celebrity. For these leaders, the final measure of their achievements would be realized by their admittance to an enduring place in communal memory. Two of the four men died in office. Abraham Lincoln, at the time of his murder, was fixed upon the task of healing the gravely wounded nation. Franklin Roosevelt was mustering his ebbing strength for the prospect of tying up the war and preparing for the complicated peace in its wake. Theodore Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson both survived beyond their presidencies to experience the problematic aftermath of leadership. Theodore Roosevelt was never able to surrender his dream of returning to power. On the day he died, he was making plans to run for president again in 1920. By contrast, Lyndon Johnson knew, with a consuming sadness, that his days of active leadership had come to an end. The 4 years left to him were more bitter than sweet, as I was there to witness. During his last months in the White House, Johnson had often spoken with me about going to Texas to work full-time on his memoirs and the establishment of his presidential library in Austin. I was looking forward to returning to Harvard, where I was scheduled to begin teaching. When I hesitated and asked if we could work out something on a part-time basis, Johnson replied with an emphatic no, either you come or you don't. On his last day in the White House, Johnson called me into the Oval Office. I need help, he said quietly. Part-time as you wish, on weekends, during vacation, whatever you can give. This time I had no hesitation. Of course I will, I said. Thanks a lot, he replied, adding, now you take care of yourself up there at Harvard. Don't let them get at you, for God's sake. Don't let their hatred for Lyndon Johnson poison your feelings about me. I turned to go, but he called me back to say one more thing. It's not easy to get the help you need when you're no longer on top of the world. I know that, and I won't forget what you're doing for me. So, in the months and years that followed, while beginning my teaching career at Harvard, I spent academic breaks and parts of summer vacations in Austin and at the ranch. I became part of a small team of former speechwriters, aides, and staff members assisting Johnson in the process of writing his memoirs. Happily, I was assigned to the chapters on civil rights and the Congress, but we all worked together, combing through files, preparing questions for recorded conversations with the president that were designed to serve as the basis for the book. During discussions about the Vietnam War, he would invariably stiffen, shuffling through his papers before uttering a word, his voice hardening and dropping to a whisper. Unlike Franklin Roosevelt or Harry Truman, Johnson was the type who would wear out the carpet, walking up and down, worrying whether they had decided something correctly. Truman, Johnson once wistfully explained to me, never looks back and asks, should I have done it? Oh, should I have done it? No, he just knows he made up his mind as best he could, and that's that. There's no going back. I wish I had some of that quality, for there's nothing worse than going back over a decision made, retracing the steps that led to it, and imagining what it'd be like if you took another turn. It can drive you crazy. Though rarely voiced, Johnson's regrets over Vietnam were turned over in his mind every day. By contrast, when he recounted stories about work with Congress on domestic issues, his vitality filled the room. He would rise from his desk and stride up and down, employing his masterful gifts for mimicry and storytelling, while impersonating Harry Byrd, Richard Russell, Hubert Humphrey, or Everett Dirksen, rendering vivid snatches of dialogue on the budget and civil rights. These were full-blown theatrical performances, the language enhanced by his facial expressions and extravagant gestures. His spirits aroused, Johnson was able to tap once more the positive energy of the early days of his presidency. In preliminary drafts of the two chapters I was working on, I quoted directly from the arresting stories Johnson told, hoping to capture something of his natural speaking style, his wide-ranging insights, impersonations, and bawdy humor. "God damn it! I can't say this," he instructed me after perusing the pages. "It's a presidential memoir, damn it, and I've got to come out looking like a statesman, not some backwoods politician." No amount of argument could persuade him that his repertoire of stories was appropriate for a dignified memoir. Consequently, his vernacular voice, outlandish depictions, and the swiftness of his mind were left on the cutting room floor, only to reemerge when the recordings Johnson secretly made during his private telephone conversations from the White House were finally released to the public. Johnson was never fully engaged in his memoirs. He repeatedly addressed the idea that history's judgment was already stacked against him. "All the historians are Harvard people. It just isn't fair. Poor old Hoover from West Branch, Iowa had no chance with that crowd, nor does Lyndon Johnson from Stonewall, Texas." If such statements contained more than an habitual strain of self-pity, they also signified that he knew that his presidency had not been all that he had hoped. His aversion to the memoir project also represented an antipathy to the completeness, the final tying up of his life's work. Finishing his memoirs meant that his long public service, his usefulness, was done with. "There's nothing I can do about it," he said, "so I might as well give up and put my energies in the one thing they cannot take away from me, and that is my ranch." During these years, Johnson's altered appearance was striking. Gone was the slicked, groomed hair, which over time grew into long white curls over his collar. His dark presidential suit and polished Oxfords had been traded in for short sleeves and work boots. An informal atmosphere prevailed in the place Lady Byrd called our heart's home. Family dinners often took place in the small kitchen or, as in so many homes in Middle America, on trays before the television in the comfortable living room. Even a cursory inspection, however, suggested anything but a conventional middle-class existence. A massive communications network enabled Johnston instantaneously to receive and transmit information to the world at large. In that era before cell phones, telephones floated on a special raft in the swimming pool. Phones were handy when sitting on the toilet, riding in any of his cars, or cruising on his motorboat. A three-screen television console allowing him to watch all three networks at the same time was built into a cabinet in his bedroom. If necessary, Johnson's voice could be broadcast on 13 loudspeakers installed at strategic points on the ranch. I would sometimes accompany Johnson on his early morning drives to inspect his fields and give instructions to the workers. The grand disparity of power between the White House and the ranch lent an inherent pathos, even comedy, to the urgency with which Johnson conducted briefings with his ranch hands. "Now," he would begin, "I want each of you to make a solemn pledge that you will not go to bed tonight until you are sure that every steer has everything he needs. We've got a chance of producing some of the finest beef in the country if we work at it, if we dedicate ourselves to the job." No detail was too small to warrant the label HP, high priority. "Get some itch medicine for the sore eye of that big brown cow in pasture one. Start the sprinklers in pasture three. Fix the right wheel in the green tractor." Status reports on legislation that had been staples of Johnson's night reading in the White House were replaced by reports of how many eggs had been laid that day. Monday, 162. Tuesday, 144. Thursday, 158. Saturday, 104. He initialed these daily memos and made further inquiries, Only 104 on Saturday out of 200 hens? What do you reckon is the matter with those hens? When I think back over these years, my most vivid memories were the walks we took in the late afternoons after the day's work on the memoirs was done. Those walks, setting out from the ranch, traversed the actual way stations of Johnson's childhood. Less than a mile down the road was the house where he was born, painstakingly restored as a public museum. He liked to check the variety of license plates in the parking lot and track the attendance sheets to see how many people had visited that week, a gauge of how the winds of historical judgment might blow. Across the field, hardly a throw from his birth house, was the cottage site where his grandfather had once lived. There, Lyndon Johnson could find refuge. There, he would revel in his grandfather's vast world of cowboy tales and ancestral lore. On a rise further down the road stood the Junction School, where his formal learning had commenced. Clustered along this road was the nucleus of his life: ranch, birth house, grandfather's cottage, school, and finally, across the road, beneath enormous pin oaks overlooking the meandering Pedernales River, the Johnson family cemetery. "Here's where my mother lies," he would say, pointing to her grave in the small burial plot. "And here's where my daddy is buried. And here's where I'm going to be, too." Rarely was there a moment of silence on our walks, a moment not filled with the sound of Johnson's voice. He found comfort and relief in moving backward in time from his tumultuous presidency to the early years of his upward climb. He spoke with pride of his teaching days in the impoverished town of Cotulla, of the work he had done to introduce all manner of activities to his Mexican-American students. He relished memories of working under Franklin Roosevelt, putting thousands of needy young people to work in the National Youth Administration, building roadside parks, school gyms, and swimming pools. He returned again and again to the story of how he had brought electric power to the Hill Country and how electricity had changed the daily lives of thousands of farm families, letting them enjoy such modern conveniences as electric lights, refrigerators, and washing machines for the first time. He spoke of the joy he took in the passage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which, despite the weakness of its enforcement procedures, had opened the door to the far larger achievements of the 89th Congress during his first 18 months as president. "Those were the days when we really got something done," he said, "the days when my dream of making life better for more people than even FDR truly seemed possible. Think of how far we might have reached if things had gone differently." He sucked in a deep breath, shook his head, and exhaled, his expression revealing a deep and unsettling well of sadness. Returning that night to my room at the ranch, making notes on what he had said, I asked myself a question I would ask many times in the years to follow. Why was he telling me all these things? Why was he allowing me to see his vulnerability and sorrow? Perhaps it was because I was a young woman and aspired to become an historian, two constituencies he badly wanted to reach, to persuade, to shape, and to inspire. Perhaps, to a lesser extent, it was because I possessed an Ivy League pedigree, which he both held in contempt and coveted. Or maybe it was simply that I listened with sleepless intensity as he strove to come to terms with the meaning of his life. For the more we talked, the more it seemed to me that he believed his life was drawing to a close. Indeed, I later found out that he had commissioned an actuarial table while still in the presidency, which statistically predicted, based on his family history of heart failure, that he would likely die at 64. Only a little more than a year into his retirement, in the spring of 1970, severe chest pains sent him to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, where he was diagnosed with angina. He embarked on a strict regimen of diet and exercise, but it was not long before he resumed eating rich foods, drinking Cutty Sark scotch, and chain-smoking. "I'm an old man, so what's the difference?" he said. "I don't want to linger the way Eisenhower did. When I go, I want to go fast." In April 1972, Johnson suffered a massive heart attack while staying at the Virginia home of his daughter Linda. Against doctor's orders, he insisted on returning to Texas to recuperate. Reprising his father's dying wish, he wanted to return to a place where people know when you're sick and care when you die. Though he managed to survive his second heart attack, his remaining time was filled with pain. "I'm hurting real bad," he told friends. "Mornings would begin fairly well, but by afternoon he often experienced a series of sharp, jolting pains in the chest that left him scared and breathless. A portable oxygen tank beside his bed provided only temporary relief. 9 months later, on December 11, 1972, Johnson was scheduled to speak at a civil rights symposium at the LBJ Library. All the leaders of the civil rights community would be present: Roy Wilkins, Clarence Mitchell, Hubert Humphrey, Julian Bond, Barbara Jordan, Vernon Jordan, former Chief Justice Earl Warren, among many others. On the Sunday night before the symposium's opening, however, a treacherous ice storm had descended on Austin. It was unclear if the event would even proceed. "So cold and icy was it," Library Director Harry Middleton recalled, "that we got word that the plane carrying many of the participants from Washington couldn't land at the Austin airport, and they would have to come here by bus." Lyndon had been quite sick the night before and up most of the night, Lady Bird remembered. The doctor insisted that he absolutely, positively could not go. Nevertheless, wearing a dark blue presidential suit and flawlessly polished Oxfords, he headed out over the icy roads on the 70-mile trek to Austin. Though he had given up driving in recent months, he became so agitated by the driver's slow pace that he took the wheel himself. Those who watched the ailing former president ascend the steps to the stage knew that determination alone drove him. He struggled noticeably to reach the lectern. The pains in his chest were such that he paused to place a nitroglycerin tablet in his mouth. If this effort was to cost him his life, so be it. He spoke haltingly, acknowledging that he no longer spoke in public very often or for very long, but, he emphasized, there were now things that he wanted to say. Of all the records that are housed in this library, 31 million papers over a 40-year period of public life, he began, the record relating to civil rights holds the most of myself within it and holds for me the most intimate meanings. While admitting that civil rights had not always been his priority, he had come to believe that the essence of government lay in ensuring the dignity and innate integrity of life for every individual, regardless of color, creed, ancestry, sex, or age. Continuing, Johnson insisted, "I don't want this symposium to come here and spend 2 days talking about what we have done. The progress has been much too small. We haven't done nearly enough. I'm kind of ashamed of myself that I had 6 years and couldn't do more than I did." The plight of being black in a white society, he argued, remained the chief unaddressed problem of our nation. Until we address unequal history, we cannot overcome unequal opportunity. Until blacks stand on level and equal ground, we cannot rest. It must be our goal to assure that all Americans play by the same rules and all Americans play against the same odds. And if our efforts continue, he concluded, and if our will is strong, and if our hearts are right, and if courage remains our constant companion, then, my fellow Americans, I am confident we shall overcome. This would be Lyndon Johnson's last public statement. By going to this symposium, Lady Bird later said, he knew what he was spending and had a right to decide how to spend it. The choice he made that day represented his hope that history would recall the time when he had been willing to risk everything for civil rights, to push in all the chips, the entire capital of his presidency. "If I am ever to be remembered," Johnson wistfully told me, "it will be for civil rights." 5 weeks after this keynote address on civil rights, he suffered a fatal heart attack. The man who needed to be surrounded by people all his life was alone. At 3:50 p.m., he called the ranch switchboard for the Secret Service. By the time they reached his bedroom, Lyndon Johnson was dead. As he had long foretold, he was 64 years old. 3 days later, he was buried in the family cemetery in the sheltering shade of the massive oak trees. Whenever Theodore Roosevelt held forth upon leadership, death, and remembrance, which was often, he sprayed sparks in every direction, like a man sharpening his blade on a grindstone. At times, he seemed to scorn the vainglory of posthumous fame. "As the ages roll by," he suggested, "it was only a matter of time before the memory of the mighty fades. It might take 100, 1,000 years, or even 10,000 years, but eventually, the inevitable oblivion, steadily flooding the sands of time, effaces the scratches on the sand we call history. Yet on other occasions, Roosevelt replaced this dismissive perspective toward personal remembrance with the romantic heroism of dying in the harness at the zenith of one's fame, with the consciousness of having work worth doing and doing it well. In the days and hours before dying, he speculated, it must be pleasant to feel that you have done your part as a man and have not yet been thrown aside as useless. For such an aggressive, self-propelled spirit, a tranquil retirement was out of the question. A restless and frantic search for meaning, service, duty, and adventure would haunt Theodore Roosevelt for the remainder of his days. The youngest man to ascend to the presidency, he was only 50 years old when his 7.5-year tenure was done. He was the youngest former president in our history. Anathema was a life without a definitive and challenging task to perform, and a spotlight in which to perform it. His daughter Alice quipped that he so fiercely craved being at the center of action that he wanted to be the baby at the baptism, the bride at the wedding, and the corpse at the funeral. He had savored every hour of being president, the greatest office in the world. He had been fortunate, he realized, having chanced to lead the nation at a time when his dragon-slaying, trust-busting, crisis-management leadership style found an answering chord in the public. He frequently spoke of the zeitgeist and how it shifted like a kaleidoscope to attract or discard particular capacities at particular times. The harmonic congruence between the times and Theodore Roosevelt reached a pinnacle in 1904, when, after serving out 3.5 years of President William McKinley's term, he had won election in his own right by what was then the greatest popular majority and the greatest electoral majority ever given to a candidate for president. Nonetheless, at the moment of this great victory, he had stunningly announced that he would not run for the presidency again, citing the wise custom which limits the president to 2 terms, a duration which he would have essentially completed by 1908. He feared that even his most fervent supporters would be disappointed by the unseemly ambition to hold office longer than it was deemed wise for Washington to hold it. With unusual care for a sitting leader, he picked and groomed a successor, his friend and cabinet member William Howard Taft. Furthermore, he worked assiduously to engineer Taft's nomination at the head of the Republican ticket. No sooner had the Republican convention opened, however, than remorse settled upon him. "I would cut my hand off right there," he told a friend, pointing to his wrist, "if I could recall that written statement." Had Roosevelt given the slightest indication to the delegates that he had changed his mind, the nomination would have been his. He felt, however, that he must honor the pledge he had made. "The people think that my word is good," he explained to his friend Bill Sewell, "and I should be mighty sorry to have them think anything else." Reiterating his unconditional support for Taft, he insisted that there was no man in the country so well fitted to be president. Immediately after Taft's inauguration, Roosevelt set sail for a year-long safari in Africa. "It will let me down to private life without that dull thud of which we hear so much," he reasoned. "It would break his fall into life as a citizen." No sooner had he come home, however, than his characteristic restlessness returned. His agitation and fidgetiness flared when one progressive delegation after another journeyed to Sagamore Hill, urging him to run for president in 1912. Under Taft, they argued, old-line conservatives were once more in the ascendant, threatening the advances of past years. Like a warhorse scenting the sniff of distant battles, Roosevelt eventually threw his hat in the ring, challenging the incumbent he had once nurtured for the Republican nomination. Then, when Taft defeated him at the convention, he consented to lead the progressive forces on a third-party ticket. With the Republican Party split in two, the only question now, Senator Chauncey Depew aptly remarked, is which corpse would get the most flowers. From the start, Democrat Woodrow Wilson was the prohibitive favorite. In mid-October, however, a chance event threatened to upend the race. While Roosevelt stood in an open car in front of a Milwaukee hotel, waiting to depart for a speech venue, an assassin raised a pistol and fired at point-blank range at Roosevelt's chest. Had the bullet not been deflected by the metal eyeglass case in Roosevelt's pocket, it would have gone straight into his heart. Defying the doctor's orders that he be taken straight to the hospital emergency room, Roosevelt proceeded to the venue. Somewhat unsteadily, color drained from his face, Roosevelt delivered his entire speech before consenting to hospitalization. His stalwart response to the attempt upon his life brought a surge of support for his candidacy. "The bullet that rests in Roosevelt's chest has killed Wilson for the presidency," one Democratic speaker suspected. A week before the election, Roosevelt had sufficiently recovered to deliver his final speech of the campaign at Carnegie Hall. In contrast to the caustic tone toward opponents that had marked his campaign, he now focused solely on the principles for which the Progressive Party stood. He believed, he told his spellbound audience, that perhaps once in a generation, the time comes for the people to enter the battle for social justice. If the continuing problems created by the industrial age were not addressed, he warned, the country would eventually be sundered by those dreadful lines of division that set the haves and the have-nots against one another. "Win or lose, I am glad beyond measure that I am one of the many who in this fight have stood ready to spend and be spent." Though Roosevelt garnered far and away the largest percentage of votes any third-party candidate had ever received, Woodrow Wilson carried the election. More damaging still, the split party had hurt the very progressive cause Roosevelt championed. In one state after another, Republican progressives, victorious 2 years earlier, were now defeated. As had been true throughout his life, when beset by political loss, personal grief, or depression, Roosevelt sought relief from pain in physical challenge, motion, and adventure. Just as his African hunting trip had cushioned his fall after leaving the presidency, so now the 55-year-old defeated candidate sailed to South America for an expedition to the unmapped River of Doubt in the heart of the inaccessible Brazilian rainforest, his last chance to be a boy. This time he nearly died from a life-threatening infection, combined with a severe bout of malaria which left him debilitated for the rest of his life. The Brazilian wilderness, Roosevelt told a friend, stole away 10 years of his life. Still, Roosevelt's impassioned supporters refused to believe that his political star had set, pressing him to run for president in 1916. Roosevelt rebuffed their entreaties, casting a realistic eye on the temper of the times. "For a dozen years I held a great place in the confidence and goodwill of the American people, and I was able to do many things which I fervently believed ought to be done." His great usefulness, he felt, had come particularly in the settlement of the coal strike, in the national parks and wilderness reserves that he had set apart for future generations, and in the busting of trusts and the regulatory legislation that had created a fairer economic playing field. "Well, I have in no manner changed," he believed. "There have been such changes in the currents of thought that it would be senseless to imagine that the Republicans, who seem to be sinking back into a kind of inert and dangerous conservatism, would even consider nominating him. Indeed, it would be an entirely unwise thing to nominate me, unless this country is in something of the heroic mood that it was in the time of the Revolution and again in the time of the Civil War." So Roosevelt bided his time, feeling superfluous, frustrated, and depressed, until a chance for vigorous action arrived in April 1917 with America's entry into the First World War. Roosevelt immediately sought permission to raise and command a division of volunteers. Long before, as a young man in the Badlands, when border tensions with Mexico had begun to boil over, he had offered to raise a company of horse riflemen. He told his friend Henry Cabot Lodge, "There is some good fighting stuff among these harum-scarum Rough Riders out here." Later, he had famously succeeded in mobilizing the Rough Riders during the Spanish-American War. So now, he beseeched President Woodrow Wilson to allow him to raise a volunteer division. Applications for his division poured in by the thousands, but Wilson denied his request. All his life, Roosevelt had displayed a disturbing, romantic grandiosity about combat. The great prize of death in battle was a reward he ranked above all others. Once before, he had even threatened to abandon his wife Edith's bedside when she was seriously ill if given the opportunity to engage in battle. He claimed at one point that all who feel any joy in battle know what it is like when the wolf rises in the heart. In another instance, he argued that the victories of war were greater than the victories of peace. His disappointment over Wilson's refusal developed into a serious depression when his four sons were deployed overseas while he remained in do-nothing ease and safety at home. When his youngest son, Quentin, was killed in battle, his grief was so deep that he felt the world had shut down upon him, finally acknowledging a sickening feeling that he had inspired his boys to take undue risks. His fiery will rekindled more quickly than his body recovered. In speeches and articles, he challenged his countrymen to honor those who had died by working together to make the country a fairer and more equitable place, by setting in motion sweeping reforms to bring justice under new conditions in a new world. Once again, his knight-errant style of leadership found a response, and before long, Roosevelt was again the most popular man in the country. Though he was urged to run for governor in 1918, he declined. "I have only one fight left in me," he told his sister Corinne, "and I think I should reserve my strength in case I am needed in 1920. The malaria he had contracted in Brazil had left him prone to fever, infection, and sporadic invalidism. A severe attack of rheumatoid arthritis sent him to the hospital for 6 weeks at the end of 1918. Cautioned that he might be required to use a wheelchair for the remainder of his days, he said, "All right, I can work that way too." There were too many things he wanted to accomplish before he died. Still in considerable pain, when he returned home on Christmas Day, he acknowledged that he would be unable to get out much for a couple of months, but he set to work drafting articles and editorials, talking with party officials, and most importantly, making plans for the next presidential election. He spent Sunday, January 5, 1919, dictating letters and proofreading a piece for Metropolitan Magazine that outlined a full-scale domestic agenda that foreshadowed elements of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He called for old-age pensions, unemployment insurance, an 8-hour workday, and collective bargaining. He insisted that it was an absurdity longer to higgle over the women's vote. He argued that government had a responsibility to ensure returning soldiers access to land and jobs. He proposed a universal national service program to mobilize young men and women from different backgrounds to work in a spirit of brotherhood for the common good. Long before, he had predicted that the rock of class hatred was the greatest and most dangerous rock in the course of any republic, that disaster would follow when two sections or two classes are so cut off from each other that neither appreciates the other's passions, prejudices, and indeed point of view. At 10 o'clock that night, after a packed day of brooding over plans for social and industrial reforms, he told Edith that he felt a curious sensation of depression about the chest, as if his heart was about to stop. "I know it is not going to happen," he assured her, "but it is such a strange feeling." The family physician was called, but found nothing indicative of heart trouble, so Roosevelt settled into bed. He never woke up. He was 60 years old. A blood clot had reached his lungs and stopped his heart. A note was found beside the bed to remind himself to get together with Republican Party Chair Will Hayes. At Roosevelt's direction, Hayes was planning a 10-day trip to Washington to bring Republican conservatives and progressives together around domestic issues. The split of 1912 had caused lingering distrust and antipathy on both sides. If Roosevelt were given another chance to lead the country, he intended to make the Republican Party once more the progressive party of Abraham Lincoln, to restore the fellow feeling, mutual respect, the sense of common duties and common interests which arise when men take the trouble to understand one another and to associate for a common object. His last waking dream, the expression of his powerful will, had looked forward to 1920, when the kaleidoscope might turn and things align, enabling him once more to grasp the reins of the leadership that he so loved. That death stalked Franklin Roosevelt in the last year of his life is clear, but only in retrospect. Certainly, by 1944, Roosevelt appeared far older than his 62 years, Many noted his gray pallor, the darkened hollows beneath his eyes, how his hand shook as he attempted to light a cigarette. While he attributed this condition and his nagging cough to the combination of influenza and bronchitis he had contracted that winter, his daughter Anna was deeply worried. She had grown accustomed to his amazing physical resilience, but when spring arrived, fatigue continued to dog him, and his strength seemed to be failing. She asked her father's personal physician, Admiral Ross McIntyre, to arrange a thorough checkup at Bethesda Naval Hospital. "I suspected something was terribly wrong as soon as I looked at him," recalled the young cardiologist, Howard Brune. "His face was pallid, and there was a bluish discoloration of his skin, lips, and nail beds. The simple act of moving from one side of the table to the other caused significant breathlessness. His heart was enlarged, there was fluid in his lungs, and his blood pressure was dangerously high." Brune's diagnosis revealed that the president was suffering from acute congestive heart failure. Throughout the exam, Roosevelt chatted amiably about a wide range of topics, repelling any serious inquiry with a shield of talk. Not once did he question the doctor, nor did Brune feel at liberty to impose his findings upon the patient. He had been forewarned by McIntyre not to volunteer information. When the examination was completed, Roosevelt flashed his celebrated smile, thanked the doctor, and left, cheerfully greeting patients and members of the staff as he made his way to the car. Later that same afternoon, Roosevelt conducted his 945th press conference. Asked how he felt, he coughed and admitted he had bronchitis and had gone to the hospital earlier to have x-rays taken. Was he alarmed? "Not at all," he retorted. He had heard that bronchitis developed into pneumonia in one case out of 48,500, so he figured his prognosis was good. Laughter filled the room, and the reporters went on their regular sequence of policy questions. Not only were the president's color and voice better, the New York Times noted, but his spirits were good, too. A week later, Dr. McIntyre casually assured the press that the president simply suffered a lingering case of bronchitis. All he required was some sunshine and exercise. Concealment of personal matters had been a major motif throughout Roosevelt's life. He had been trained from boyhood to present a consistently confident and encouraging demeanor before his invalid father. During the 6 agonizing weeks he spent in the hospital, after contracting polio, he had projected a uniformly optimistic image. By buoying up others, he had learned to uplift himself. In his mother's family, Franklin's cousin Laura Delano recalled, "You just never said you were sick." Similarly, in the weeks and months that followed during the spring of 1944, Roosevelt chose to ignore his illness, always keeping the potential gravity of his condition at arm's length. He simply did what Dr. Brune's new regimen required, without asking questions. He took digitalis every day and displayed no interest in his blood pressure readings. Religiously, he followed the prescribed low-salt, low-fat diet and shed so much weight that he quipped proudly, "I'm a young man again. Look how flat my stomach is," at which point he slapped himself with a sense of glee. Roosevelt's steadfast heartiness proved infectious. Innumerable accounts from his closest colleagues reveal that he was invariably able to rouse himself and focus on the task at hand. Even on days when he admittedly felt like hell, he remained, according to one aide, so cheerful in spirit and good-natured that he did not seem seriously ill. While Frances Perkins had been initially appalled by his appearance early that spring, she was so relieved at the vitality he exhibited when he returned at the end of April from a 2-week rest at financier Bernard Baruch's South Carolina plantation that she did not have another moment's concern about him until very near the end. Yet no matter how much he tried to ignore the state of his health, no matter how brightly he burnished his image, Roosevelt knew that on bad days, willpower alone kept him going. Why, then, did he decide to run for a fourth term in 1944? 4 years earlier, in the spring of 1940, Hitler's invasion of Holland, Luxembourg, Belgium, and France had created a crisis for Western civilization that warranted breaking the cherished two-term tradition, in Roosevelt's mind and in public opinion. By the spring of 1944, he had already been in office for 12 years, the longest presidential service in American history. Should he attempt, he asked friends, to extend the shattered precedent once more and run for a fourth term? In late May 1944, 7 weeks before the Democratic Convention, Roosevelt's indecision continued. The gargantuan jobs of ending the war and envisioning the peace to follow were far from a fait accompli. Hanging in the balance was nothing less than the survival of our nation and of democracy itself. 1 million men and supplies had been transported to embarkation posts in southern England, awaiting the signal to begin the invasion of Normandy. All the major European capitals remained in German hands, including Paris, Amsterdam, Warsaw, and Athens. Japan controlled the Philippines. Terrible decisions to have to make, Roosevelt's cousin Margaret Sukley recorded in her diary. In private conversations with Sukley, Roosevelt disclosed his dilemma. On the one hand, the future being so challenging, he felt a profound sense of duty to carry on as long as he was able. On the other hand, if he knew that he was not going to be able to carry on for another 4 years, it wouldn't be fair to the American people to run for another term. The conclusive factor would be the condition of his health in the weeks ahead. So immersed was he in the tasks at hand that events seemed to determine the state of his health and the level of the energy he had so carefully husbanded. His spirits rose with the news on D-Day, June 6, 1944, that the beach landings had been successful and that the troops, taking fewer casualties than expected, were advancing up the hills. In the late afternoon, Roosevelt held a press conference. "A great moment in history," one reporter observed. The president sat back in his great green chair, calm and smiling. His cigarette was cocked at the angle they say he always has it when he is pleased with the world. Throughout the proceedings, another reporter noted, he seemed happy and confident, though he warned against overconfidence. "You just don't land on a beach and walk through. If you land successfully without breaking your leg, walk through to Berlin. And the quicker this country understands it, the better." That evening, Eleanor observed her husband looked very well and seemed himself again, full of plans for the future. 2 weeks later, circumstances once more provided a tonic. Roosevelt looked in the pink of condition when he signed the GI Bill of Rights, the massive program of education and training for returning soldiers that would broaden the educational horizons of an entire generation. That Roosevelt had conceived the program 18 months earlier, that he had begun post-war planning so long before the cross-channel invasion, was deemed, in speechwriter Sam Rosenman's judgment, one of the greatest examples of statesmanlike vision. It was that vision, Perkins concluded, Roosevelt's uncanny ability to keep his head above the welter of administrative problems, to see the whole picture, and keep his eye on the objectives of highest importance, that persuaded all the key members of the cabinet and White House staff that the president, regardless of diminished energy and health, was the superior man to lead. 5 days before the Democratic Convention was set to open, Roosevelt finally offered himself for a fourth term. His decision was driven primarily by his considered belief, given his long experience and wide-ranging knowledge of the central players and the stakes involved, that he was the best man to carry the war to its conclusion and lay the foundation for peace. He announced he would accept his party's nomination a fourth time and serve as president if, so ordered by the commander-in-chief of us all, the sovereign people of the United States. 1 week later, the delegates to the Democratic National Convention nominated Franklin Roosevelt by acclamation as their candidate, a fourth time for president of the United States. In the fall, Roosevelt had to demonstrate that he had the stamina to compete with his young Republican challenger, New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey. Roosevelt knew that his opponents were circulating a whispering campaign that he was no longer physically or mentally competent. "People have been asked to believe that I am all worn out and sick," he said. There was but one sure method to disprove such gossip. He had to put himself before the people and let them make up their own minds about his capacities. He had to conduct an old-fashioned rough-and-tumble campaign. On a single day in New York City, 3 million people lined the streets as the president was driven 50 miles in an open car through Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx, across Harlem, down Broadway, and into the Garment District. The tail of a hurricane had produced bone-chilling rains that pelted down upon the multitudes. Rain soaked the president's suit, beaded his glasses and trickled down his cheeks. The miserable weather neither quenched his smile nor stopped his progress, and the crowds loved him for it. The energy of the crowd gave him a sense of belonging, gave him happiness. They kept him so warm, he afterward told Perkins, that he didn't realize he was wet through. Throughout the rest of the campaign, he was full of fight, and at the end he looked healthier than when he began. He had gained 12 pounds, as well as gained election to a fourth consecutive term. When Roosevelt was inaugurated on January 20, 1945, he had 82 days to live. From hindsight, critics would debate whether he was too debilitated to function effectively in his final months, whether, during his grueling marathon of diplomacy with Joseph Stalin and Winston Churchill at Yalta, he had given too much for too little. At Yalta, his strength was manifestly waning. His physical condition was deteriorating. Yet in the end, Roosevelt achieved his two foremost objectives. He secured Russia's commitment to join the invasion of Japan, a struggle that was expected to cost 1 million American casualties. And he also secured Russia's support for the creation of a new world organization for peace that would arise from the wreckage of the most destructive war in history. Finishing the war and preparing for peace were the twin goals that propelled Roosevelt through his final days. Everything else was put on the back burner. Never did he take the time to share confidential briefings about the war with his vice president, Harry Truman, nor, an appalling lapse, did he brief his successor on the existence of the atomic bomb. When asked later if he might have been better prepared for the presidency, Truman generously replied, "Roosevelt did all he could." Roosevelt reserved what strength remained for the great unfinished business of his administration. He was planning to go to San Francisco in late April, where representatives from 50 allied nations were to convene in order to establish the framework for the United Nations. After San Francisco, Roosevelt planned to go to England for a state visit. So excited was he at the prospect that he was unable to keep it a secret. He brought it up in conversation with Canada's Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, and again with Perkins. His eyes sparkled with anticipation when he told Perkins that Eleanor would accompany him to England and that he had urged her to order some fine clothes so she would make a really handsome appearance. The future promised to hold a crowded and jubilant itinerary. They would journey by ship to Southampton and then by rail to London, where they would stay at Buckingham Palace with the King and Queen. He would drive with the King through the streets of London, address Parliament, and then spend several days with Churchill at his estate, Chequers. Churchill predicted that the genuine and spontaneous reception the president would receive from the British people would be the greatest reception ever accorded to any human being since Lord Nelson made his triumphant return to London. "But the war," Perkins protested. "I don't think you ought to go. It is dangerous." Roosevelt cupped his hand over his mouth and whispered in her ear, "The war in Europe will be over by the end of May." It greatly comforted Perkins, she later said, that he was so sure, 2 weeks before his death, that the end of the war was at hand. His excitement over these future travels notwithstanding, Roosevelt could not conceal the depth of his exhaustion. To recover and prepare his speech to inaugurate the United Nations, Roosevelt departed the White House at the end of March for a fortnight's vacation in Warm Springs, hopeful that this place of almost preternatural rejuvenation for him would once more do its work. "It wasn't just a matter of our hoping the trip would help the boss," Secret Service agent Mike Riley said. "We just naturally assumed it would." This assumption was shared by everyone. For more than a dozen years, Franklin Roosevelt had been a national emblem of resilience, his confidence in recovery and victory infusing and infused by the people. "The thought never occurred to me," White House speechwriter Robert Sherwood later wrote, "that this time he might fail to rally as he always had." On the morning of April 12th, Roosevelt's colors seemed exceptionally good as he went through his mail and sat for a portrait. "He looked smiling and happy and ready for anything," his cousin Margaret observed. Suddenly then, his head slumped forward and he collapsed from a cerebral hemorrhage, never to regain consciousness. Franklin Roosevelt had died as Theodore Roosevelt had once yearned he might die himself, as a leader in harness in the midst of battle, his life dissolving into the task before him. At his death, he was endeavoring to gain victory in a war to save democracy and to lay the groundwork for global peace. That he was listed as a casualty of war is a simple statement of fact. It was not the grandeur of a knight-errant's death, but his quiet heroism, the willingness to persevere as long as he was able, that was so telling. Though he rarely spoke of his legacy, Roosevelt had a keen sense of history and his own place therein. An inveterate collector, he had directed his White House staff to save every document, every letter, every scrap of paper that came into his office. 6 years before his death, he had bequeathed his papers to the government and pledged part of his Hyde Park estate for the building of a library and museum, a formal act that initiated the system of presidential libraries. A confident Roosevelt wanted to give historians full access to his personal and professional papers to make their own evaluations of his leadership. In his own judgment, as Roosevelt made clear when he laid the cornerstone of his library, the key to that leadership could be found in the dependable, reciprocal relationship he had established with the people he served. Of the papers which will come to rest here, I personally attach less importance to the documents of those who have occupied high public or private office than I do the spontaneous letters which have come to me and my family and my associates from men, from women, and from children in every part of the United States, telling me of their conditions and problems and giving me their opinions. So unique was the tender intimacy of Franklin Roosevelt's leadership that in the days after his death, the New York Times reported, in the streets of every American town, strangers stopped to commiserate with one another. Over and over again, one heard the same lament, "We have lost our friend." The greatest human tribute, one citizen from Trenton wrote, is that because one man died, 130 millions feel lonely. On Good Friday, April 14, 1865, Abraham Lincoln rose with great and unaccustomed cheer to greet the final day of his life. The evening before, the city of Washington had been in dazzling holiday illumination. At long last, the punishing Civil War was coming to an end. The Republic had been saved. Candles glinted in the windows of every building, gorgeous lanterns swayed along the walls, and flags flew from the roofs of every housetop. The streets were filled with people drunk with joy, strolling arm in arm, talking, laughing, singing. 10 days earlier, the Confederate capital at Richmond had been evacuated. The following week, General Robert E. Lee had surrendered his army to General Ulysses Grant at Appomattox. Each passing night, it seemed, brought new reasons to celebrate. A suspension of the draft had been announced by the War Department. Purchases of military supplies had been halted, ports opened for trade, and Grant himself was coming to the White House. Lincoln had breakfast that morning with his wife Mary and their oldest son Robert, a captain in the Army and a member of Grant's staff who had just returned from the front. Word came to the breakfast room that House Speaker Schuyler Colfax had arrived. Colfax was planning a cross-country trip to California and wanted to confirm that Lincoln had no plans to call an extra session of Congress. Lincoln assured him that he did not. "How I would rejoice to make that trip," Lincoln told Colfax. "I can only envy you its pleasures." And then, rising from his chair, Lincoln outlined a message that he wanted Colfax to deliver to the gold and silver miners in the West. He had been thinking about the hundreds of thousands of returning veterans who would be looking for jobs. He believed that in the great Western country, from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific, lay an inexhaustible supply of mineral wealth, the surface of which had hardly been scratched. In that vast mining region, there was room enough for all, for returning soldiers and new immigrants alike. "Tell the miners that I shall promote their interests to the utmost of my ability, because their prosperity is the prosperity of the nation, and we shall prove in a very few years that we are indeed the treasury of the world." At 11 a.m., Lincoln headed for his regularly scheduled Friday cabinet meeting. The forbidding war room of maps, battle planning, and military paraphernalia that had characterized cabinet meetings for longer than 4 years had on this day acquired a brighter mood and a serious new subject: how best to proceed with reconciliation and reconstruction. "This is the great question before us," Lincoln announced, and we must soon begin to act. From the outset, Lincoln wanted to establish the healing tone that must prevail in the months to come. Enough lives have been sacrificed, he said. We must extinguish our resentments if we expect harmony and union. Indeed, Lincoln considered it auspicious that Congress had adjourned on March 4th, the day of the second inauguration, for there were men there who, if their motives were good, were nevertheless impracticable, and possessed feelings of hate and vindictiveness in which he did not sympathize and would not participate. To the question of what to do with the rebel leaders, Lincoln made clear that none need expect he would take any part in hanging or killing those men, even the worst of them. He understood that their continued presence might hobble the process of healing, but he would prefer to simply frighten them out of the country, open the gates, let down the bars, scare them off, emphasizing his intentions with a gesture of uplifted palms, as if shooing sheep from the paddock. They should be informed, however, that while no attempt will be made to hinder them if they voluntarily chose to leave, if they stay, they will be punished for their crimes. General Grant, having just returned from Appomattox, joined the cabinet meeting and related the story of General Lee's surrender. "What terms did you make for the common soldiers?" Lincoln asked. "I told them to go back to their homes and their families," Grant responded, "and they would not be molested if they did nothing more. As for the officers, they could keep their private horses and their sidearms. Grant believed it would be an unnecessary humiliation to call upon them to deliver up their personal property." Hearing this, the president's face glowed with approval. For 3 hours and more, the cabinet members hashed out problems of communication and commerce, reopening post offices and federal courts, reestablishing connections to allow for commercial and social intercourse, the nuts and bolts needed to suture relations with the defeated rebels and begin the recreation of a unified country. Lincoln found any simple imposition of federal power upon the states abhorrent. "Let 'em up easy," Lincoln repeated on several occasions. "Let 'em up easy." He felt strongly that it was not his executive prerogative to undertake to run state governments in all these southern states. Their people must do that, though I reckon at first some of them may do it badly. The process of reconstruction must be built step by step and remain sensitive to unfolding events. Of utmost importance, the process must be flexible. "Didn't our chief look grand today?" Secretary of War Edwin Stanton remarked to a colleague after the meeting drew to a close. "That's the most satisfactory cabinet meeting I have attended in many a long day." There was general agreement among the members of the cabinet that Lincoln had never seemed more glad, more serene. The indescribable sadness, which had previously seemed to be an adamantine element of his very being, one member observed, had been suddenly changed to an equally indescribable expression of serene joy, as if conscious that the great purpose of his life had been achieved. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, Lincoln and Mary took a leisurely carriage drive. "You almost startle me by your great cheerfulness," Mary told Lincoln. He replied, "And well I may feel so, Mary. I consider this day the war has come to a close." And then he added, "I have never felt better in my life." As the carriage rolled toward the Navy Yard, they spoke of their future together once his presidency was over. They were both relatively young. Lincoln was 56, Mary 46. They hoped to travel with their sons, to journey through Europe, visit the Holy Land, cross the Rocky Mountains, and see California and the West Coast for the first time. Finally, they would come full circle to Illinois, where their marriage had begun. The carriage returned to the White House just as a group of old friends, including Illinois Governor Richard Oglesby, were taking their leave. "Come back, boys, come back," Lincoln implored them. He had been through a long, starving time and badly wanted to relax, chat, perform, and especially read aloud from one of his humorous books. "They kept sending for him to come to dinner," Oglesby recalled. "He promised each time to go, but would continue reading the book. Finally, he got a peremptory order that he must come to dinner at once." An early dinner was required, for the Lincolns had evening plans to go to Ford's Theater to see a light comedy, Our American Cousin. After dinner, Lincoln entertained another small group of friends, including Massachusetts Congressman George Ashman. As the hour reached 8 o'clock, Lincoln stood up. "I suppose it's time to go, though I would rather stay," he said, the note of reluctance clear. "It had been advertised that we will be there, and I cannot disappoint the people." His word was out. His promise must be kept. Lincoln's assassin, the actor John Wilkes Booth, was a familiar figure in the theater world. Having learned by midday of the president's plans, Booth had decided that this night would prove the optimal chance to kill the man he considered an even greater tyrant than Julius Caesar. He believed posterity would honor him for the deed, and he would thereby achieve immortality. Thus was set in motion the most iconic moment of tragic horror in the history of the American presidency. Booth was already inside the theater when the Lincolns took their seats in the comfortable presidential box. At 10:12, Booth's calling card gained him access to the rear of the executive box. The president was leaning forward in his rocking chair, his right hand on his chin, his arm on the railing. Booth moved silently forward to within 2 feet of Lincoln. He raised his derringer, pointed it behind Lincoln's left ear, and fired. In a white fog of smoke, Lincoln slumped forward. Leaping from the box to the stage, Booth caught the spur of his riding boot on a regimental flag decorating the box. His awkward fall broke his leg, but before hobbling off the stage and escaping into the alley, he raised his dagger and shouted the words, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always to tyrants." There was a savage, terrible irony in these words. The dying president had warned long before that lawlessness, murder, and mob rule would create fertile ground for a Caesar or a Napoleon, men of towering egos who would seek distinction by pulling down rather than building up. The dying president, who had worked much of his life to counter extremism, hate, and vindictiveness, who that very afternoon had counseled his colleagues against exercising arbitrary power over the vanquished southern states, was himself the victim of a racist extremist who would be remembered in infamy only for the man he killed. Mr. Lincoln had so much vitality, doctors reported, that for 9 hours after sustaining the wound that would have killed most men instantly, he continued to struggle. At 7:22 the following morning, that struggle came to an end. Abraham Lincoln was pronounced dead. "Now," Stanton said, "he belongs to the ages." Stanton's tribute proved not merely poetic, but an accurate description of the fame and influence that connects the moment of Lincoln's death to the living values he passed on to us and to all succeeding generations. What are the components of this legacy of living values, and how do they get passed on over time? From the very moment he first appeared before the people as a 23-year-old in Sangamon County, Lincoln connected education and history, remembrance of the past, and freedom. He singled out education as the most important subject which we as a people can be engaged in, so that every man could thereby be enabled to read the histories of his own and other countries to appreciate the value of our free institutions. As a 29-year-old, Lincoln worried that memories of the Revolution and the ideals for which it stood were growing more and more dim by the lapse of time. Through history, he had hoped that the story of our country's founding would be read of and recounted so long as the Bible shall be read. He considered history, an understanding of how we came to be, the best vehicle for understanding who we are and where we are going. The master story Lincoln told grew deeper and simpler throughout his life. It was the narrative of our country, the birth of our democracy, and the development of freedom within our Union. At the time of his great debates with Stephen Douglas, Lincoln invited his audiences on a communal storytelling journey so they might collectively understand the dilemma of slavery in a free country and, together, fashion a solution. At Gettysburg, he challenged the living to finish the unfinished work for which so many soldiers had given their lives, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. At the second inaugural, Lincoln asked his countrymen to strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds. These same words nourished Franklin Roosevelt. He drew upon them, he said, because Abraham Lincoln had set goals for the future in terms of which the human mind cannot improve. Lincoln never forgot that in a democracy, the leader's strength ultimately depends on the strength of his bond with the people. In the mornings, he set aside several hours to hear the needs of the ordinary people lined up outside his office, his time of public opinion baths. Kindness, empathy, humor, humility, passion, and ambition all marked him from the start. But he grew, and continued to grow, into a leader who became so powerfully fused with the problems tearing his country apart that his desire to lead and his need to serve coalesced into a single indomitable force. That force has not only enriched subsequent leaders, but has provided our people with a moral compass to guide us. Such leadership offers us humanity, purpose, and wisdom, not in turbulent times alone, but also in our everyday lives.
Leadership in Turbulent Times was written by Doris Kearns Goodwin and read by Beau Bridges, David Morse, J.O. Sanders, and Richard Thomas, with an introduction and epilogue read by the author. It was recorded at Simon & Schuster Audio and CDM Sound Studios in New York, Baker Sound in Philadelphia, and Dave & Dave Recording Studios in Los Angeles. The recording engineers were Terry Hogan, Noriko Okabe, Kathleen Conti, Charles de Montebello, Ron Mukherjee, Jeff King, Tucker Dalton, Catherine Cook, Viana Vigno, and Brianna Villarreal. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Leadership in Turbulent Times was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Leadership in Turbulent Times is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also by Doris Kearns Goodwin from Simon & Schuster Audio. Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. The Most Revealing Portrait of a President and the Presidential Power Ever Written. Read by Gabra Zachman and Jim Frangione. And The Bully Pulpit. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Read by Edward Herman.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.